You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 324 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And yes, we're going into a little more lightened quarantine from yesterday, Monday, the 11th of May, an accordion effect, as the government is saying, allowing some people out and some people less time. We'll see how it works. So far, so good. But of course, please, everybody out there, stay safe, heed the warnings. And this episode, I'm very proud to say that we've created a three-part series. So it'll be 324, 325, and 326 with the Canadian journalist Nadia Drost, who's talking to us from Toronto in Canada. And she's telling us about the article she wrote, and of course, the deeper stories behind it, about migrants crossing the Darien Gap, a journey which she did within the company of her husband and photographer Carlos Villalon. And we'll be talking about what she went through, what the migrants have gone through, stories from the migrants, and this will be over three episodes. It's epic. It really is. It's amazing that we were able to get three episodes out of this, and I know you're going to enjoy it. It goes far beyond just the jungle trek that a lot of us think that it might be. It goes far beyond just a nice observational piece. If you haven't read her article in the California Sunday magazine, do so. I highly recommend it. I urge you to read it so you understand what people are going through. Nadia spends time with Cameroonians, Angolans, Pakistanis, Sri Lankans, Haitians, Bangladeshis, and more. And of course, it's just a terrifying tale of human suffering. And then, of course, there are upbeat moments too when she was able to follow some of these people back and who have successfully arrived into their family units in the United States. So there are positives that come out of this too, but on the whole, it's just a terrifying story, and of course, which can break the human spirit indeed. So I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of Adrian Alsimer for Columbia Reports, and then we'll be back with Nadia Drost on the line from Toronto talking about the Darien Gap and the migrant crossing. And of course, this will be a three-part series. Thank you for listening, and you are going to enjoy this. Bye-bye.
My name is Adrian Alsema, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for May 12, 2020. Colombia's government allowed the reactivation of more economic sectors and regions where no coronavirus has been detected on Monday. Health experts have criticized the decision because the government doesn't have the data that would allow any responsible decision-making. Medical federations have warned that even a minor surge in COVID-19 cases could easily collapse the country's healthcare system, as promised reinforcements never arrived. According to the Colombian Medical Federation, private healthcare intermediaries have used the crisis to fill their coffers. This has left hospitals on the brink of bankruptcy, children with cancer without treatment, and healthcare personnel to resign. According to a recent Federation poll, 40% of healthcare personnel have considered quitting their job in the last week. As many have no personal protection equipment, doctors and nurses consider the risk of getting infected or infecting others too great. The agriculture minister and more than one-third of Colombia's governors will be investigated by the Supreme Court on suspicion they embezzled or misappropriated emergency coronavirus aid funds. The widespread corruption prevented emergency aid sent by the national government to reach the country's poor during the ongoing lockdown. The agriculture minister allegedly sent subsidized credits meant for small and medium-sized farming businesses to large firms. Colombia's military intelligence chief and the military attaché to Washington, D.C. were fired over the National Army's illegal spying practices. The profiling of journalists, NGOs, politicians, and even government officials with American resources now threatening U.S. funding. Despite increased international pressure, none of the officials allegedly involved in the criminal activity has been charged. President Ivan Duque ordered the army to facilitate a botched invasion by American and Venezuelan mercenaries, according to the neighbor's president Nicolas Maduro. The two Americans and at least 11 Venezuelans were arrested last weekend, allegedly when entering Venezuelan waters. An American private security firm confirmed it sought to arrest Maduro but was caught. The governments of the U.S. and Colombia have denied any involvement in the operation. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the final segment of the Colombia Calling podcast this week, episode 324. I've told you, I've been working up to this, and I am so happy to have Canadian journalist Nadia Drost here on the show. Some of you will know, and some of you will have seen the article that she wrote that I've shared around the ether about the Darien Gap and her crossing of the Darien Gap with her husband, Bruno, and collaborator, the war photographer, conflict photographer, Carlos Villalon. It was out in the California Sunday magazine, and she crossed with Cameroonians, Pakistanis, Angolans. I mean, everybody needs to read this article, and I'm not going to lie. In 2020 so far, this has been the best article I've read. It's phenomenal. It's harrowing. It really shows that this is no joke. And I just make a reference to episode 303 of the Colombia Calling podcast when we had Daniel Eggington, a Brit who wanted to do it as an adventure. Unfortunately, he wasn't allowed to go. I don't think he would have made it through, because reading what Nadia and her team got through, it's just, it's out of this world. And the writing is phenomenal. Get your hands on it. Check out the link. I'll put it back on the Facebook page. Nadia, welcome on Colombia Calling. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
No, and you are, I mean, for doing this, you are my hero. I'm not going to lie. you are my hero because, I mean, these kind of adventures are far behind me, and, you know, two kids and you know, everything else. I just can't do it. And bad knees. I can't do it. Now, how did this come about? You said, let's do the Darien Gap. Let's hike. And I guess, you know, reveal some of what the migrants are going through when they cross from Colombia to Panama and then beyond.
Yeah, well, I mean, the interest in this story kind of started years ago. I mean, as you know, I lived in Colombia for a decade, and so I had heard about this migration route for years. But it wasn't until, you know, at some point in the kind of spring of last year, 2019, we started seeing that the numbers of migrants were really shooting up who were crossing the Darien Gap and then continuing to Mexico. And so Bruno and I thought, okay, this is the moment to finally attempt, you know, this story. Bruno, my husband, who is a cinematographer, and we work on a lot of television stories together, he had tried to do it the year before for an assignment with Univision and his friend and collaborator, Simone Bruno. And the trip was a disaster. You know, their equipment was first ruined, then a second set of equipment was stolen by paramilitaries. They were separated in the jungle. Bruno was caught by the Panamanian police, sent back to Colombia on the weekly garbage boat. And in a way, his trip was kind of, you know, a blessing in disguise, in that it made us realize, okay, if you want to do this trip, you need a lot of resources to do it well and successfully and safely, and you really need to plan it out carefully. Also taking, you know, into account that this is Colombia, this is the Caribbean coast, and like with all journalism in Colombia, as you well know, you know, you absolutely can't plan for everything, and you really have to kind of roll with the punches a lot. So we started planning this trip in the spring of last year, and we are regular collaborators for the PBS NewsHour, and so we pitched them a series. And we wanted to basically trace the route of migrants from Colombia into Panama across the Darien Gap, and then we wanted to catch up with them in Mexico and see, you know, how their situation was faring there before they tried to make it to the U.S. border. This was a really costly trip to organize, and we were really lucky to get the support of the Pulitzer Center. And then I also approached the California Sunday magazine and proposed, you know, writing a long feature for them. They went for it. And we, very early on, pulled in Carlos Villalon. And Carlos is a friend of ours. He's a longtime Chilean photographer living in Bogota. And the Darien Gap has kind of been, you know, one of his personal projects for over a decade now. And, you know, there's very few journalistic teams who have crossed the Darien Gap. Of the few who have, pretty much all of them have done it with Carlos. And Carlos has really developed a deep knowledge of the area and who's who. And, you know, we decided, okay, we want to do this trip with him. And he was really instrumental in helping, you know, connect us with guides who were trustworthy. And, you know, because you're really, you are trusting your lives to whichever guides you hire to bring you across the gap. And they needed to be guides who were, you know, respected in the area. There are a lot of bandits in the Darien Gap. We were one of the only teams or one of the only groups of people that we had heard about who were not robbed or assaulted. And I think a lot of that, if not all of it, had to do with the fact that we were with a group of guides who, you know, they weren't the type of men who you'd want to come across in a dark alley and or in the middle of a jungle. And, you know, they were known entities. A lot of these people are local. They recognize each other. And so I think that, you know, potential robbers would have recognized that it was, you know, just a better idea not to mess with them.
It's amazing. You know, we unwrap all of what you just said now. And it's like this, you know, first, so early on, you said so nonchalantly that, oh, yeah, yeah. And Carlos had his equipment stolen by the paramilitaries. I mean, these are not nice guys.
Yeah, yeah. <She's>
right. and then we go into Carlos Villalon, who's a friend of the podcast, was on many, many months ago about his book, Coca, the Lost War on Drugs.
Right. Yes. Phenomenal book.
But, you know, it's how many times, do we know how many times Carlos has crossed the Darien Gap?
Yeah, I think he's done it 4 times now and definitely visited the region, you know, more times than that. But I think in terms of actual crossings, I think it's been 4.
Wow. I mean, he's a straight talker. There's no messing around with Carlos at all. And
absolutely that. Yeah.
but I want to ask, you know, it's okay. So you've got these kind of, I have this image of kind of like sort of land-based pirates guiding you through. You wouldn't want to run into them in a dark alleyway. They're, let's say, an unseemly lot, but they're your unseemly lot. So, you know, you're with them, you feel a lot more comfortable. But I mean, reading your article, and you mention, of course, the assaults. And prior to your departure, you hear of people being robbed and sexually assaulted and a killing a few days beforehand. I mean, you're an outgoing journalist, you're adventuring, but surely you're thinking about your security as well, not just with the guides. So you're just like, this is a real risk.
Absolutely. That was definitely on our minds. And, you know, we were trying to talk to as many locals, as well as, you know, I wouldn't say government officials so much, but people on both the Colombian and Panamanian sides who had their finger on the pulse and could kind of read the situation for us. And it was evident that not only were the number of migrants crossing in those months of, you know, the spring and summer of last year really rising, but so were violent incidents. So that was definitely on our minds. And we actually postponed our trip by several weeks because our guide had warned us that the Panamanian border police, which is called Xenofront, they had, in response to, you know, the increased number of assaults, they had really ramped up their own operations along the border. And so they had kind of swarmed. I mean, I shouldn't say swarmed because, you know, really we're talking about this huge expanse of land, and I'm not sure how many, units of Xenofront, picture. I mean, they're kind of like ants, you know, in a huge forest, but they had concentrated their operations near the kind of launch points of where migrants were crossing. And so since what we were doing, we were going to be going with guides who were smugglers, and they were at great risk taking us, we really couldn't be seen by Xenofront. It would have gotten our smugglers in jail immediately. It would have also caused, big problems for us. And I mean, I can explain to you, if you're interested, kind of how we legally arranged our crossing. But in any case, it was obvious that the time was just, it was too, you know, caliente. It was too, there was too much police activity in the area at the time because of all of these operativos, police operations trying to kind of stem the trade and clamp down on the crime. And so our guide told us, you know, we have to wait until this calms down. And so we actually, you know, we did wait several weeks, but, you know, here's the thing is that, the crime was still really high. There are just inherent dangers in doing this crossing. And once we had made the decision about, well, you know, let's try to do it the safest way possible. And for us, there were several measures that we could take to mitigate those risks. And I think the most important decision that we made was, who do we go with? We knew that we had to go with somebody who, as I mentioned, you know, was a well-known entity locally, and also somebody who just knew the Darien like the back of their hand. It's so easy to get lost there. They needed to be trustworthy. We had to be sure that they weren't going to abandon us in the middle of the jungle like so many smugglers abandon migrants. So I think, you know, just the decision of who to hire as your guide is kind of, it's the make it or break it decision.
I do have to ask.
Yeah.
A question.
So I felt very confident about, you know, the people who we went with, and that was, that was a huge help. Yeah. It was everything.
And these guys, these are smugglers. Are they affiliated to any particular group, or they just play off all sides?
They're independent operators. They, You know, they're locals. Smuggling is not their only profession. You know, they do several odd jobs. One of them was a longtime miner, gold miner and gold panner in the Darién. A lot of the Afro-Colombian communities, you know, both on the Caribbean and Pacific sides, that's been, you know, a mainstay for the subsistence of a lot of these communities. And that was part of the reason why he knew the Darién so well. I mean, he had been mining there for like 30 years. And so, you know, I guess I just want to emphasize that a lot of these smugglers, you know, it's like with everything, there's good eggs and there's bad eggs. And, you know, we hired really stand up people. And when they would smuggle migrants, based on what they told us, and I do believe them, I think they really, you know, they actually cared about them. They cared about their well-being and would really go out of their way to help migrants. You have a lot of smugglers who don't do that. They promise migrants that, you know, they'll deliver them all the way to Panama. But migrants don't understand what that means. They hear Panama and they think that's their end destination. But if they're leaving from Capurganá, which is, you know, at the time that we went, that was the main trailhead, you reach Panama within your first day of walking. And then it's often another week to the first settlement when you kind of get spit out of the Darién Gap. So smugglers might be truthful in saying, oh, I'll take you all the way to Panama. But migrants don't know that that is actually just a minuscule part of the journey. And these smugglers are Colombian. And as soon as they cross over into Panama, the level of risk to them increases exponentially. So, you know, to be caught as a smuggler in Panama, the stakes are very, very high for them. You can be jailed for years, if not, you know, more than a decade. And so they're on this route that we took, there tends to be a point, you know, basically 2 to 3 days into the trail where smugglers say, you know, beyond this point, we don't go. But many of them they're not truthful towards the migrants about how much longer the migrants have to go. So they'll leave them at a river and just say, you know, just follow the river downstream, and maybe in a few hours you'll come to your destination, or by tonight you'll come to your destination, or tomorrow you'll come to your destination, when in fact it's days away. And so what happens is that a lot of migrants, you know, they're so weighed down by what they're carrying. They're really not prepared for this trip. They have very little idea most often about how long it will take, what quantity of food they need. And so when they hear this false news that they're about to arrive at their destination, a lot of them just drop so much of what they're carrying because they don't think they need it anymore. So they actually drop their food. They drop their tents because they think they're going to be sleeping in a bed at night. And in fact, they have to walk 4, 5, 6, 7 more days. So it's that misinformation that is part of what makes this trip so, so dangerous for them. And that's what, you know, also marked a huge difference between the trip that I did with Carlos and Bruno, because we were prepared, we had help, we knew how many days food to pack for. We had a really good idea of what the week was going to look like. And that makes the experience just like day and night for what we did and for what migrants did.
I want to get more into the migrants a little bit later, but we say, how many days exactly were you hiking?
So our team took 7 days.
7 days.
And the article that I wrote describes a journey of 5 days of a group of Cameroonians and Pakistanis. I was actually with that group only for 1 day a night. And it was through really extensive interviews with them once I saw them again in Panama and then later on caught up with them in Mexico that I was able to reconstruct the days that I wasn't with them. But so the journey that I wrote about in the magazine piece was really only one part of the journey that I took. And, you know, after Carlos and Bruno and I walked with the Cameroonian and Pakistanis, they went ahead and we stayed behind, basically waited just one night. And we came across yet another group of migrants, quite large, who were Haitians. We also came across a Cameroonian from the group that we had been walking with, but he had been left behind by his group, George, exactly. He's covered in the magazine piece. He was really injured and he fell behind his group and they simply couldn't, you know, go back for him. There was really nothing that one could do for him except for get either a helicopter or a horse, none of which are available in the middle of the jungle. And so, you know, we came across George. That was a really difficult moment. And that's kind of when the Darwinian aspects of the Darien Gap are brought to sharp relief. And you really, you realize through experiences like what George had that it's really survival of the fittest. And you're also really out there on your own. Migrants do help each other. But there really is only so much that they can do often. You know, we came across George and we were in a far better position than migrants to help him out. I mean, we had guides, but he was a really large man. And I mean, there was no way that our guides could carry him for like 7 days through the jungle. It was just an impossibility. Just to, you know, keep letting you know who we came across. We traveled with Haitians for the rest of our trip. Actually, we started out with Haitians and a small group of Sri Lankans who they didn't have kids, so they just kind of motored ahead. The Haitians were a really great group for us to travel with because, first of all, most of the Haitians left Haiti years and years ago and went to Brazil and Chile to work and live. And those countries became kind of untenable for them to continue living in. And that's why they decided to come north. So a lot of them spoke either Spanish or Portuguese. So for communication, it worked out well. We could actually communicate with a lot of them. You know, it's really surreal how in the middle of the jungle, you come across people who, you know, so many different languages of the world. I mean, we met people who spoke Bengali, Pashto, Haitian Creole, Arabic. And, you know, in our team, you know, we managed a total of about 4 or 5 languages. And so for interviewing purposes, obviously, you kind of gravitate more towards the people that you can communicate with. The Haitians also had a lot of kids. There were several pregnant women in the group. There were babies in the group. And so because of that, they just had to walk slower. And that really suited us because we had camera equipment. You know, Carlos was taking photographs for the magazine. Bruno was filming for our PBS News, our piece, and you need to stop and do your work. And so the pacing worked out well for us. And what was so strange was just how we kind of gathered people along the way. I kind of started thinking of us as you know, this snowball at the start of, you know, at the top of a mountain, and as it kind of progresses and falls down the mountain, it just keeps on, you know, gathering more and more snow. And that was kind of our group just kept on expanding, because all of a sudden one morning, this group of Bangladeshi men just showed up at our campsite, and they were wearing nothing but the clothes on their back. And they had been robbed of everything, and not once, but four times. All of them were violent assaults. All of their food, tent, you know, passports, money, everything was stolen. They hadn't eaten in days. And so they obviously, you know, kind of sought shelter in our group. Then a couple of days later, we came across a small group of Haitians and a family from Ghana, who had been separated from the larger group of Haitians that we were traveling with. And they also, several of them had been robbed. They also hadn't eaten in many days. One of the women was 6 months pregnant, you know, really dizzy, really having a tough time. And that's when the trip for us kind of started taking a very worrisome turn, because here we were with, at that point, you know, around 40 migrants, and they had all run out of food. We were pretty much, you know, nearing the end of our food supply. And, you know, you're with people who are at their most vulnerable. They haven't eaten in days. They're very, very scared. And they see that you have food. I mean, as you know, there are journalistic rules that we have to follow about, you know, not intervening in the stories that we report on. And that means not, you know, giving our interview subjects money or assistance, or in this case, you know, food, anything that could kind of change the outcome of the story. And in this case, I didn't really feel a debate, you know, inside of me about, okay, do I follow the journalistic rules or not? It had really got into a life or death situation for these migrants. Was I not going to give them food and try to explain that was somehow more important, that, you know, I follow these journalistic guidelines, which I think are meant for, you know, very different circumstances. So there really wasn't a question in my mind, nor Bruno's or Carlos's mind. It was really obvious. Of course, we have to share our food. And it was very difficult. You know, some of these Bangladeshis in particular, who really hadn't eaten in days and days, I mean, they would hover over our food and start crying. And it was hard not to be able to give them more food than we did. We also had to save food for our guides, because they had to do this whole journey on the way back without being able to replenish their food supply anywhere. And that's very hard for other people to understand, you know, when they're absolutely famished and they see that there is a food supply, but it has to be reserved for the guide's return trip. That's very hard to, you know, to be able to understand in these kind of circumstances. So the food supply was something that became very difficult to manage. And, you know, in the last couple of days of the trip, you know, we all ran out of food. And I think that, you know, the experience for us journalists was so markedly different than for the migrants, because, you know, we knew we were going to reach the end. We knew how long it was going to take. And, you know, barring an injury, we had confidence that, you know, we were going to make it out. And for the migrants, that's just always, you know, the end destination is actually like a chimera. Like, it just, they they keep on imagining that it's about to appear, you know, around the next curve of the river or after the next hill. And it kind of becomes, you know, this illusion for them. And psychologically, that affects the experience of their whole entire trip, you know. I'm sure that it makes them hungrier and more desperate, and it's so much more difficult to manage those feelings when you don't know when it's going to end and if it's going to end.
This ethical issue is so interesting. And of course, as you say, there's no debate. This is life and death. You wrote about it in the article. You came clean, you're saying, and you ran out of food, obviously putting yourselves at risk, you know, risk of injury, risk and so on, but you're in a much better situation. I think sometimes, you know, people read articles and don't understand this, you know, the subjective and the objective. And at the same time, you know, you're much better off than the migrants. They've been coming from all the way on the other side
of
the world.
For sure.
But you're in this parallel existence to them. And in a lot of stories, you know, you can separate yourself from the story. But in this one, there are no parallels. You become part of the story. You are there with them. And I just think you're with this snowball effect, as you say. And, you know, just now that we've gone through 7 different nationalities, and it beggars belief that it should be like this. And I just think that the ethics are thrown out of the window. And you did say in the article, I mean, the journalism ethics are thrown out of the window, but you said in the article, it became a rule, the children eat. And I'm thinking of all these Haitians with young babies and women who are pregnant. This must have really weighed on you. I mean, really, really weighed on you. Did you have any, let's say, emotional collapse in the 5, 6, 7 days that you were walking?
Not during the time that we were walking. I think that when you're walking, and this is where, you know, I think the journalist's experience is a little bit similar to a migrant's experience, is that you're really just focused on moving. It's just, you know, one step after another. You're focused on your destination. The hard thing, you know, the challenge of being a journalist is you have to make sure that you're documenting what you need to at the time to be able to get tell your story afterwards. And so, you know, for me, that meant sitting in my hammock for like 2 hours with my headlamp every night when I really wanted to go to sleep, but I was madly scribbling in my notebook so that I wouldn't forget, you know, any of the dialogue or forget anything. And it is definitely, you know, I don't want to say it's not emotional when you're in it, but you're all kind of in survival mode. There's definitely adrenaline kicking in. And so you don't really have time to process anything. I felt like emotionally the harder moments actually came afterwards. When people, you know, ask me about the difficulties of having done this reporting trip, for me, it actually wasn't the physical crossing of the Darien Gap. I won't say that it was like a walk in the park, but I found that less challenging than confronting, you know, the more emotional, the emotional impact that it takes on yourself as a person who comes across, you know, one story after another that is very, very desperate, seeing the toll that it takes on migrants. And so when we got to Panama, there's kind of like 2 way stations. There's 2 small communities that migrants tend to stay in before continuing on their journey. And the second one is called Peñita, and it's a camp for migrants. It's also a very small village. We're talking population 100. But they are required to stay there until they can get cleared, actually by American law enforcement, who are not physically present in La Peñita all the time. They do come and visit, but in La Peñita, you have Panamanian migration authorities who are taking the biometric registration of every single migrant. So they're taking, you know, iris scans and fingerprint scans and passport scans, and they are sending all of that information to American authorities, and they're cross-checking everything with international databases, you know, Interpol, FBI databases. And once migrants get cleared and, you know, for security reasons, they're vetted, then they can continue on their journey. And that can take a week, it can take 10 days. But for migrants who come from, you know, as you have it, mostly Muslim majority countries, countries that the U.S. government deems so-called special interest countries, because they are determined to harbor terrorists or terrorism, those nationalities end up having to wait 2 months, 3 months, sometimes 4 months in this tiny little Panamanian hamlet before they're able to get security clearance and continue on their way. And this is kind of a long explanation as to explaining the kind of environment that's in Panama. I really thought of it as it was kind of like a clearinghouse for this accumulation of experiences that migrants had. So we have to remember that before migrants even cross the Darien Gap, the journey's already been very difficult for them. A lot of the circumstances that they're fleeing from are really terrifying. A lot of them are fleeing really horrific violence, conflicts, or, you know, extreme poverty, political persecution. And so a lot of them are already, you know, they're carrying traumas from their homeland with them. And they're going on this incredibly uncertain and then very, very dangerous journey. And so in the Darien Gap, they come across, you know, physically the most difficult part of their journey, but they have to do it with carrying all of the, you know, traumas that they've been bringing for whether it's weeks or months or sometimes even years that they're on this migration route. And by the time they get to Panama, that's kind of the first time in a while that they can they're just sitting and waiting and resting and recuperating. And I think that emotionally, that's kind of the moment where they start absorbing everything that they've been through. And in terms of interviewing, that's kind of, you know, a calmer moment to be able to talk to migrants about their experience and about their lives. And, you know, I had a lot of interviews where migrants really emotionally broke down in front of me, sometimes had, you know, really relived the trauma that they had left behind. Sometimes had what I would probably term, you know, similar to a panic attack. And so it's kind of like the, you know, the emotional weight and the physical suffering that they have endured. It just like all comes down on them in Panama. And then they somehow have to kind of, you know, they have a long way to go still. And then catching up with them again in Mexico, was a whole other, you know, there was a whole other set of challenges.
Well, unfortunately, there's just not enough time this week to have everything we want to put in it. And the Mexico segment and further interview questions and conversations with Nadia Dross, journalist from Canada, will have to be extended over another couple of episodes. So we've got two more weeks of this. It's incredible. Be sure to tune in next week on Tuesday to hear the second segment of Nadia's trip and, of course, what she's learned all the way along from the Darien Gap all the way up to Mexico and into the US. Some incredible stories for you. And, of course, the week after that, we'll wind this down and get the final overview from Nadia up there in Toronto now, but hear more about what this migrant passage really means from Colombia up through into Panama and then beyond. A fantastic episode today. Fantastic episodes ahead for you. Thank you again for listening. Thank you for those who've thrown some money at the Patreon campaign or at buymeacoffee.com. Your support is really, really welcome. I'm going to sign off now. I've been Richard McColl for episode 324 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And yes, we'll be back on 325 with Nadia Drost once again. Bye-bye.